Hi, I'm Molly Wood. This is The Source Code. Lots of interviews we do for Marketplace Tech go way longer than we have time for on the radio or even on the podcast. But these people are so interesting that we created something called The Source Code, which are very lightly edited interviews that let our original sources, see what I'm doing there? Let them shine. Today's installment is Maria Clave. She's a computer scientist and the first woman president of Harvey Mudd College. That's a liberal arts school in Southern California focused on engineering, science, and math. And while only 18% of computer science graduates nationwide are women, half of Harvey Mudd's grads are. Maria Clave and I had a long conversation about how to improve diversity in the tech industry and at that school in particular. So without further ado, here's Maria Clave, The Source Code.
Let's start with startups in Southern California. You're part of this project to bring more startups to Southern California. You say that diversity needs to be a huge part of that. Can you tell me a little bit about that work?
So first of all, I should start by saying that there's a couple of reasons for wanting to bring more startups and in particular more venture capital to Southern California. One is simply that we have great universities here doing great research. We have people who want to start companies. And, you know, we have some great incubators and other kinds of facilities to help start companies here. But we have trouble when companies that start in Southern California start scaling. And once they need really big capital investments, they're often told they have to move to Silicon Valley. But then we look at Silicon Valley, and what we see there is their saturation. There's the housing prices are escalating unbelievably there, but also companies are raiding each other for software engineers day in, day out. And so I think there's a feeling from some of the people in Northern California that wouldn't it be great if Southern California became able to attract the kind of capital and entrepreneurs so that it could actually sort of balance off Silicon Valley. And I was asked to join the board of the Alliance for Innovation, Southern California Innovation. And essentially I said, you really don't want me unless you want to focus on diversity and inclusion, because I will just make your life miserable. And the person who was leading this initiative, Steve Poizner, got back to me a day later and said, how would you like to start a working group on diversity and inclusion in, you know, this space? And so I have spent my summer vacation reaching out to people across the country and inviting them to join the working group. We now have close to 50 people, and it's an amazing mix of people from all of the different kinds of communities that make up the general entrepreneurship infrastructure. So we have VCs, we have people from private equity, we have researchers from various universities that focus do research on diversity and inclusion in business organizations. We have industry leaders, just a ton of wonderful people. And our goal is to come up with a set of recommendations for best practices and also metrics that we should ask organizations to report out on. And, you know, I realize it's a huge issue. I'm realistic about the fact that we might put a lot of effort into this and it might not make a dent. But given how great the people who have already signed up to be part of this are, I'm cautiously optimistic we'll get somewhere.
I want to get to why it might not make a dent in a minute. But before that, as tech companies sort of seek this more diverse workforce, what are some of those best practices? What are some concrete things that you've come up with?
So first of all, we haven't done the work yet, so it's not me who's come up with them. But a number of the people who have joined the group, so for example, Joan Williams is at UC Hastings, and she has done a work on bias interrupters. So the whole idea is we all know we live in a society that has bias and that pretty much all of us contribute to that bias. But how do you actually – what are the things that you can do that would actually – make a difference? Or as Lauren Zelaznik would say, we know that when hospitals brought in checklists, the number of problems in surgeries went down by double digits and in terms of percentages. So one of the things we're thinking about is what are the things we can do? So for example, we certainly know that at Harvey Mudd, we've needed to train our search committees who are doing searches for faculty in order to make it more likely that a woman or a person of color would be hired. Because we do a lot of programming around diversity inclusion about how we can try to remove those biases from everything we do in terms of what's happening in the classroom and outside of the classroom and so on. And so there are people who've done a lot of similar kinds of work about what needs to happen in industry. So another person on our working group is Joel Emerson from Paradigm, who works with companies who want to remove bias. We have Kieran Snyder, founder of Textio, where they try to help people who are posting job ads and doing hiring, recruiting, promotions and so on for removing bias. So the idea is to bring people together who have experience either in actually taking action within their own workplace or helping others to do that, and people who have done the research, and really come up with a set of best practices and recommended metrics that any entrepreneurship hub can take advantage of.
And some of these are not as hard as you might think, right? I know that one of the reasons that Harvey Mudd is credited with improving its ratio of female to male computer sciences engineers has to do with rewriting class descriptions. And that can apply to job descriptions too, right?
Well, I mean, it's partly, I wouldn't say rewriting the description. It's more like how we actually teach the course, but also how we tell people about what the purpose of the course is. So, for instance, if I tell you that this particular course is about learning to program in Java, well, you might find that really interesting or not. But if I tell you that this course is about creative problem solving in teams, looking at real life problems, and it happens to use computational approaches with Python, but the big thing that it's about is creative teams problem solving, it's a lot more likely that many people will be interested in that, because most young people like to think of themselves as creative. Many people, particularly at Mudd, love to work on teams, and most people want to make a difference in the world. So if you're putting those components of what's going to happen in this course first, then you're more likely to start more students off feeling enthusiastic. But you can't just tell them that. It has to be real. So one of my favorite examples right now is that we had a course that's a required course for all Mudd students, whether or not they're engineering majors, that is typically about transforms, which is a mathematical device, let's say, that gets used a lot in engineering. And we had 20 years of students not liking the course, not seeing why it mattered, and women doing less well than men in the course. And so the engineering department decided to change how it was taught. And they added context by having an application to an underwater robot that students had to build in teams. And they also, you know, flipped the classroom so that most of the time actually in a classroom was working in teams and, you know, both doing individual quizzes and then team quizzes that didn't count for anything but give you a sense of whether you understood it or not, and then also doing a lab with the underwater robots. And that course, it was just amazing. It took them a year and a half of work to get it ready. But when they taught it for the first time a year ago, first of all, it became one of the most popular courses that are required in our core. It also demonstrated better learning outcomes for both men and women. And actually, the women did slightly, though not statistically significantly, better than the men. So, you know, it was a ton of work to redo the course. But I think this idea about how we actually provide environments that engage and support everyone, generally, that makes it better for everyone.
Yeah. So when you hear people say, you know, there's a pipeline problem, or girls are not as interested in math or computer programming, obviously that happened in a high profile way at Google earlier in the summer. Do you think to yourself, no, this comes down to, you know, the way that classes are taught and or job descriptions in the real world, that analysis is based on incomplete data?
I think that analysis is based on not incomplete, but just incorrect data. There's just tons of research that shows that actually girls and boys do as well as math. Women and men do as well in math. But in addition to how we teach, there's also what the workplace is like. So I was sitting at lunch with a bunch of our students, including many students of color, and they were talking about how just being a person of color, how that causes people to expect less from you. And I said, well, you would not believe the literally hundreds of times in my life somebody has told me that I couldn't do something because I was female, that I wouldn't be good at it, that, I wouldn't succeed. And of course, it's so much worse for people of color. I mean, it's just, it's like if it's bad for women, then it's 10 times as bad for people of color. So I think it's not just how we teach in universities and colleges, but it's how we treat people once they actually enter the workforce. And we know that the reason that women are and people of color are twice as likely to leave tech jobs within the first 7 to 10 years as white men is not because they didn't like the work, but because they felt they weren't getting the level of credit, recognition, and opportunities for promotion. And so it's not enough just for us to graduate them. We really have to make the workplaces supportive and engaging for everyone. We have to make sure that we demystify the path to success. So it has to be the case that whether you're part of the dominant group or not, you understand how you can be more successful and you have access to those opportunities.
And I imagine, all of this is a process as you learned at Harvey Mudd this past spring when the college had to cancel classes and minority students were issuing demands to the administration, including more money into counseling services for students of color. What was that process like and what changes are you making so that everyone feels like they can thrive at Harvey Mudd?
So I guess the first thing I want to say is, we are on a journey. And we, for the first 30 years of our existence, we were really primarily white and male in our student body and in our faculty. And now we are gender balanced in our student body. We have a lot of women on our faculty as well. We're about 40% female on the faculty, which is a lot for a science and engineering school. And we have a lot of women in leadership roles. So 5 of our 7 department chairs are female. Our dean of the faculty, who's the chief academic officer, is female for the first time ever in the history of our college as of July 1. But now we have a racially very diverse student body as well. For 3 years in a row, 20% of our incoming class has been Hispanic, and another 10% roughly has been Black or multiracial with one parent Black. And we also have good representation of Native Americans, Pacific Islanders, Asians as well. So it's a diverse student body. And there's just no question that we have, just because we have grown up serving mostly white male students, there will be parts of our traditions, our habits, that feel much more comfortable for a white male than for a person of color or a female. And so we're busy working on those things. And, we had some really bad luck this past academic year, the biggest of which was the death of 2 students, one before the year started and the other one in early February. And but we had all kinds of other things go wrong as well. And so as a result, and this, of course, was happening on many campuses, we had, and certainly on all of the undergraduate Claremont campuses, we had protests. And we had been in conversations with our students of color for the previous 2 academic years and had made lots of changes based on input from them. And so we were fairly surprised when all of a sudden it just went into crisis. And I think the thing that scared us most was we really felt there was a possibility that we would have more student deaths or that we would have more of our students who were feeling marginalized have some other major emotional or mental health episode. And so we essentially went day to day trying to make sure that we could protect our students. And there was so much intensity of angst about our students. At some point we had, out of our 800 students, we had about 60 who were on a watch list where we were trying to make sure that nothing untoward happened to them. And, you know, typically we have 5 or 6 students. And so at some point we decided to cancel classes for 2 days because we just felt we had to take the pressure, lid off the pressure cooker. And 80% of our faculty voted in favor of doing that. The presidents at the other colleges supported it. And it was such a good thing to do. I mean, I had lots of reservations, but it was such a good thing. So I would say we went through something like 6 weeks where every day the majority of the faculty and staff were getting up and saying, please, please, let's keep it together for one more day. Let's keep our students safe. Let's try to keep everyone safe. And that's really stressful. So, of course, we're entering this new academic year, trying to have paid a lot of attention to the things that we think were the causers of stress. So we're doing a review of our core curriculum that will involve seriously involve input from our current students and our alumni. We are have put in place additional mental health resources, and we'll be gathering more input from students on what else is needed. We have lots of work on diversity and inclusion, and again, we'll be seeking input. And then we're putting a lot of effort into rebuilding our, sometimes I say rebuilding our community, sometimes I say fostering community, but, you know, really trying to help a community of people who suffered a lot in the last semester. So I'm the eternal optimist, as I always say. So I'm optimistic, but I have no doubt we're going to face challenges. And one of our commitments is we want to listen to everyone. And we don't want to privilege those who are yelling and screaming over those who are speaking quietly, but we don't also want to ignore the people who are yelling and screaming. So we think it's important to hear what everybody says.
You're a computer scientist. You went to school in the 60s and 70s. Are there things about your path that create some of that optimism or were uniquely good and helped you get to where you are?
Well, I think I totally lucked out that. So I actually studied mathematics, pure mathematics, for both my undergraduate degree and my PhD. And I think I really lucked out that after I finished my PhD, which was in 77, I realized that the job opportunities for academic computer scientists were way better than those for mathematicians, even though I actually got a tenure-track academic position in mathematics. And so I went back to school to do a second PhD and got hired as, within 10 months, I never completed the second PhD because people were so crazy for computer scientists in academia. Mm. And today, again, is a time when people are crazy for computer scientists. And, one of the things that I like about, you know, what has happened in my life is that it's been necessary to keep on learning all the time. And I think that for everyone, you know, as we look at what's facing us, you know, particularly in view of automation and artificial intelligence, we're going to have a huge need for people to be able to continue to learn, not just as 18 to 24-year-olds, but as people who are in their 40s and 50s and even 60s. And I think one of the things I feel in terms of optimism is this is a good thing, not a bad thing, in the sense that learning and being able to open doors, even when you're halfway through your career or three quarters of the way through your career, that's a really good thing. So, you know, it certainly was a huge asset to me that I was willing to learn when I was, already had a PhD, but willing to sort of start from scratch in computer science. And I think that's going to be something that we have to encourage tons of people to embrace.
And then as people go into the work world, you know, you became known for a moment in 2014 where you were in conversation with Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella. He said that women should not necessarily ask for a raise. And you immediately jumped in and said you disagreed with him. I mean, how much of functioning as a successful woman in tech has to do with questioning the way that men think of the world and trying to change those beliefs on the spot? Has to do with advocacy, basically.
I think it's really important. And I think the complicated part is, I mean, I'm certainly someone who's known for being quote unquote outspoken. You know, there are other mm-hmm. adjectives you could use as well, but that's as good a one as anyone. And, you know, I'm willing to challenge people on the spot and fight for people to be willing to consider different viewpoints from the ones they're used to. I don't think you can really survive as a woman in technology without being able to do that. But I think you also have to have something else in that you have to have a range of ways to use the dresses. And sometimes, so first of all, it really helps to be polite when you're challenging something. And I tried to be, I happen to adore Satya Nadella. I think he's an amazing CEO of Microsoft. I have a real admiration for how he dealt with that because, you know, within a few hours, he'd sent out an apology to every employee in Microsoft saying, I got the answer wrong. And, mm-hmm. you know, being willing to admit that you got something wrong is a big plus for me. But I think you have to be outspoken, but I think you also have to be respectful. And I think you have to try to bring people together rather than polarize them. And that's, I'm really good at polarizing people. So I focus these days, I mean, I don't mean to polarize people. It's just, that's my sort of basic personality is that I will streak truth to power any day. And that's not always the best way to go around fostering change. So I think you have to be outspoken, but you also have to, it's not about women versus men. It's not about VCs versus feminists. It's not about any of these things. It's about we're a society that's going through change and lots of challenges. And the places we're going to be successful is when we are able to bring people together. And sometimes, like last semester at Harvey Mudd College, you're going to work as hard as you possibly can. It's going to feel like you're not making any progress at the time. But what I know, having looked back, you know, over the summer and all of the work that we've done during the summer, even though it was incredibly hard, we are in a better place. We have a better understanding of what the challenges are. And we're more, I think we're in a better position to be able to actually make the changes we need to make.
And as you look around the tech industry now, what do you think about this particular moment in time? You know, I think the conversations about Uber have raised obviously broad questions across the industry. You're seeing the venture capital industry go through some, you know, soul searching and some pretty dramatic shakeouts. Do you think we're on the verge of change in the tech industry?
Well, as the eternal optimist, of course we are.
yes.
I for any woman who's been around the tech industry for the last decade, Uber is not a surprise. The stories that are coming out about VCs are not a surprise. We all know mm-hmm. it. It's just that the media is talking about it more now. And of course, I'm glad the media is talking about it more. I think I'm hoping that there's now enough concern that we'll be able to bring together the many, many people who care deeply about diversity and inclusion to actually make a dent, to move us forward. It feels to me that this is the moment, but, you know, I know there are lots of people who are just as skeptical as I'm optimistic. And, you know, I'm putting my 2 cents worth of effort into trying to make this change, and hopefully it will change. But, you know, it's not done till it's done, and it's probably like the journey at Mudd. It's never done.
Maria Clave is president of Harvey Mudd College. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you. Pleasure to talk with you, Molly.